Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What if Sleeping Beauty, Rip Van Winkle, and the fall of the House of Usher were true stories? While we know them to be fiction, all three of these stories have characters afflicted with one bizarre symptom, extended, unwakeable sleep. While such tales sound quaint today, in the 1920s, a form of encephalitis known as sleeping sickness was a well-documented, if poorly understood, phenomenon. It struck about 5 million people worldwide and killed one in three of its victims. As a journalist who specializes in science writing, Molly Caldwell Crosby has a professional interest in this strange disease, but her interest is personal as well. Her Dallas grandmother came down with the disease when she was 16 and stayed asleep for 6 months. Molly Caldwell Crosby writes about it in her new book, Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Molly, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we have this pretty strong collective memory of the influenza epidemic. Why has this one sort of faded from the radar screens?
That was one of the things I wanted to explore in the book, because at the time, 9,000 articles were written on this subject, and it clearly affected people all over the world and countries everywhere. And what I really just sort of came to see is that I think it faded behind just that enormous 1918 flu that got so much attention, that this one sort of got lost in the shuffle of that. And I also think it was the time period itself, the 1920s followed by the 30s. As I say in the book, I think it faded behind the brightness of one decade and the darkness of the next.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you had a lot of other infectious diseases that people were worried about, things like polio and just many things that were sort of out to get you at that time.
Right. And a lot of the doctors who were researching this particular disease were also researching polio, meningitis, a number of these diseases. So you're right. There was several of them circulating.
So what happened to people who came down with this?
Typically, they got some kind of an infection, which even today they're still trying to figure out what that infection was. Some people think it was the flu. Some people think it was strep. But it was some kind of a sore throat, fever, typical infection. And then what followed was what they called the acute stage, where people fell into, most of the time, fell into a deep sleep that could last weeks or months or days. And it wasn't that they were in a coma. They could be, you know, awakened just briefly. They could sometimes eat or drink, but then they would fall right back asleep again. And this, you know, as I said, could have lasted months at a time. Most of those people, about a third of them died. A third recovered with no major problems. And then a third of them did recover, awakened from this sleep, and then years later came down with what became known as the chronic symptoms of this disease. So this was a really two-punch kind of disease.
Mm-hmm. And there was no predicting when somebody might sort of wake up and at least temporarily be able to live a normal life.
Exactly, right. And when they did wake up, they were usually very weak. It took months to recover. In my grandmother's case, she missed, she was never able to graduate from school. She was weak for a full year after that. So it was a hard disease to get over, and then these chronic symptoms that came later were even more cruel, I think.
Yeah, and let's talk about what was happening while they were asleep, because mm-hmm. many people, including your grandmother, reported that although they were asleep, it was sort of like trying to climb out of a bad dream. You could hear things going on around you, but just not will your body to move.
Right, and that was one of the really fascinating things about researching this. So many of the patients who did awaken kept records of it or discussed it or told family stories about it, and they were all very much aware of what was happening around them, which made it even more frightening for them because it was like being imprisoned by your own body. And the same was true of the patients in the book Awakenings by Oliver Sacks. He was treating a group of these patients about 40 years after the epidemic, and no one had really realized that they were aware of what was happening inside of them until they awakened and could talk about it.
There's one really poignant case of a young woman who'd been diagnosed with the disease. She was acutely ill. She was asleep. And the doctor told her parents that she wouldn't survive.
Right. I know that was a really touching story when I found that among the doctor's case studies. And he quietly told the parents and said, "We've done everything we can. She is not going to survive this." And turned around and tears were falling down the girl's face. So she was able to hear. I think at that moment, his name was Dr. Tilney. I think Tilney at that moment recognized that these patients were truly hearing and were aware of all of it.
And of course, Tilney was kind of a pioneer in trying to understand this. Can you talk for a minute about when epidemiologists and just clinical physicians started to see this happening as a pattern of cases as opposed to just some isolated odd stories?
It was a little hard to pinpoint because it started during World War I in the trenches, and it actually occurred on both sides of the war. A Parisian doctor started noting patients coming in, soldiers who just would not wake up. Again, not in comas, they just wouldn't stay awake. And another doctor named Konstantin von Economo was noticing the same thing on the opposite side of the war in a medical clinic in Vienna. And he was actually the doctor who gave it the name encephalitis lethargica, which literally means the swelling in your brain that makes you sleepy. And they both went on to publish papers within a week of each other. At that point, because it was so difficult to disseminate all this information during the war, other countries really weren't hearing about it. So it was a surprise. That was about 1916. It was a surprise 2 years later when it appeared in London in 1918. And then it was a surprise when it appeared in New York in 1919. So it did spread the globe. And everywhere it went, it seemed to surprise doctors.
And there wasn't really a clustering of cases in that, you know, you didn't have four people in the same family coming down with it. Is that right?
Right. The encephalitis itself was not contagious. It was not being spread among family members or people in hospital wards. But it was shadowing some kind of infectious disease for it to be considered epidemic, which it certainly was after it struck, you know, as many as 5 million people. They just have not figured out what disease it was shadowing, which is what makes it still an unsolved mystery.
How do they study the brain in the days before MRIs and other kinds of scans to know what's going on within a living human brain?
That was a really fascinating aspect of it for me. Brain study was still so new at this point. In fact, this is the first generation of neurosurgeons. They didn't actually have anyone to train them. They had general surgeons train them. And World War I had helped kind of launch this brain study because when the war started, they were still wearing leather helmets. They were so wholly unprepared for the new kind of machinery and technology in war. By the end of the war, obviously, they were in steel helmets. But they, it's still the damage done to the brain at that point was giving the neurologist a chance to kind of map which parts of the brain were affecting which parts of the body and personality. And it was also helping pave the way for modern psychiatry because a lot of these soldiers ended up with shell shock.
What would the standard treatment have been for something like this back then?
For the encephalitis?
Yeah.
Really, all they could do was sit and wait. They had to keep the patient alive. So in a lot of cases, it was feeding tubes and keeping them hydrated and IVs. And then just waiting it out. I mean, this is in the era before antibiotics. They weren't, you know, regularly using fever reducers at the time. And so they really, their hands were tied. They just kind of had to wait the long sleep and see what happened.
You know, it's really interesting because it occurs to me that even, you know, a generation before this time, people who had this probably, you know, there would have been no feeding tube technology and they just would have died within a week or two.
Right. And they did, especially von Economo, he went back and looked throughout history trying to find signs that there may have been similar epidemics in the past. And as you mentioned, there were several around the time that Sleeping Beauty was written, several around the time Rip Van Winkle was written, and Washington Irving at the time was actually living in England. And there had been a number of these sleeping sickness epidemics in England. And again, at the time that Poe was writing his short stories, also the premature burial, which was one of the great fears of the time, all of these are written around the time that doctors start noting. Sometimes they called them neurological complications from the flu. They often seem to go hand in hand with flu pandemics. Sometimes they were called epidemic coma, or they just recorded signs of mental disease following long sleep. But no one had ever called it this big sleeping sickness before, and this 1916 was certainly the largest and longest lasting.
You know, you mentioned that premature burial. It was relatively common for people with this to be declared dead when, in fact, they were still alive but just sleeping very deeply.
Right. In fact, my grandmother was declared dead three different times. And so I can only imagine how tormenting that was to the patients themselves because they could hear what was happening and how disturbing and traumatic. But this is before they had real diagnostic tools to measure the pulse. You know, they were just feeling with their hands. And at that point, if your pulse got so shallow, you could be declared dead. And it happened with people in comas as well.
So you mentioned that this packed a 1-2 punch. Let's talk about what happened down the line. So people would, at least 2/3 of the people, would finally awake from their long sleep and get up and sort of walk around again. Many of them were reported to never be the same.
Right. What seemed to be happening, the encephalitis at the acute time of the illness was causing, the swelling in the brain was causing damage to the basal ganglia, which is like the switchboard in the brain. So as the damage was done in the years that followed, those messages became more and more static traveling through that switchboard. And it had a very different effect on adults and children. In adults, it tended to affect the movement. And the most common, by far, was Parkinson's disease. And it's not really Parkinson's had been around for 100 years, but like today, it was really considered a disease of advancing decades in life, 60s, 70s, 80s. And at this time, it became so prevalent that the average age of onset was around 32 years old. Mm. So patients as young as, you know, 18 and 19 could get this disease and develop Parkinson's. And then they slowly, this Parkinson's became more and more extreme until they were unable to move at all, which was the tragic cases that Oliver Sacks found in his book Awakenings. For the children, their brains had not finished growing, so in a sense they were kind of pliable. And especially the frontal lobe, that's the last part of the brain to finish growing until you're in your early 20s or so. So the damage done to the children was even worse, if you can imagine, than the adults. It was affecting the frontal lobe, which controls personality, emotions, inhibition, self-control. And these children developed severe personality disorders. 70% of the children had severe psychological changes after this illness. And it ran the spectrum from a lot of OCD, was starting to appear obsessive-compulsive disorder, Tourette's syndrome, all the way to violent insanity. And many of these children had to be put away in asylums after they attacked siblings or tried to kill their parents. They attacked people on the streets. They were unfit to live with society after that.
I wonder if the research into a disease like this today, trying to understand what was happening back then, is also influencing researchers who want to understand people who get things like OCD today but haven't had a major traumatic illness, whether there might be some kind of viral element to all of this.
I think so. I think that has continued to be debated over the years, both with schizophrenia, OCD, a number of different personality disorders. They're starting to find sometimes links in cases where it could have been a viral start. In this case, the way one doctor explained it to me was that if you get an infection, his example was strep, and the body, it's an immune response. The body starts attacking the brain cells rather than the actual bacteria. And the same could have been happening with the virus. If you had the flu and then your body sort of mounted this overreaction in its immune response, it would start swelling. I mean, that's the typical reaction of the immune system is swelling. And in this case, it was in the brain and then caused lasting damage. So I think they do continue to kind of look at this, whether or not these diseases are truly organic, caused by something else, a virus or a bacteria, that then leads to schizophrenia, OCD, other personality disorders.
So what was the fate of the children who came down with this and who were sort of forever damaged by the swelling in the brain?
Not good. Sadly, when I was searching out case studies, there wasn't actually a single book on this subject from the 1920s when I was researching it. So I was relying completely on these early case studies, the doctor's records, and a lot of them did not say what happened to the patients. But I think most of the children spent their lives in institutions and eventually developed Parkinson's like the adults.
Mm-hmm. And you say that there were no books. I suppose once it was gone, people just moved on to thinking about something else?
Yes, there was a book put out by the Matheson Commission, which is the commission that's discussed in this book, that's hired by a sleeping sickness survivor to try to find a vaccine. And they worked throughout the 30s trying to do that. And so, yeah, the Matheson Commission is really the only group I know of that put out a book, or they put out three, actually, 1929, 1931, and I believe 33. But there was no general book circulating, and that I found in the old medical historical records.
Molly Caldwell-Crosby is my guest. She is a science journalist whose new book is called Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Molly Caldwell-Crosby. Her new book is called Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One thing I really like about the book is that although there's not sort of a final solution to exactly what the problem was, it reads in many ways like a mystery unfolding. And there were a lot of really passionate doctors who just refused to brush this aside and not work on it. Can you talk for a minute about Dr. Jelliffe, who everybody was saying this was hysteria? And he said, no, this is not hysteria.
Right. His name was Smith Eli Jelliffe.
I know Jelliffe.
I'm never sure how to pronounce some of these names. But and as I was saying earlier, this is an interesting time in brain study. They at the time considered the mind and the brain one specialty. And today we really divide that between neurology and psychiatry. And Jelliffe was just sort of the classic example of this. He was a friend of Freud's. He was really exploring psychoanalysis. He was also looking into psychosomatic medicine. So he was open to the ways that this disease was also affecting the mind and the personality, whereas a lot of doctors were looking purely at the focus, the organic disease, the damage done by the encephalitis, studying the autopsy samples. He was starting to look at how this was spreading within the mind. It was really a disease of the brain altering the mind.
Mm-hmm. And how much contact did doctors who were working on this in different parts of the world have with one another? You mentioned, you know, initially that there wasn't much communication about infectious disease, even from one country to the next.
Right. A lot of these doctors, American medicine was not what it is today. And it was considered inferior to a lot of places in the world, especially in the 1890s and early 1900s. So a number of these American doctors that I discuss in the book, most well-known American doctors would go abroad. They would go to Berlin, Vienna, Paris, and study with the doctors there in the clinics. They often spoke several of these languages in order to read the medical journals coming out of there. So they forged these relationships early on with a lot of European doctors. And that was the case with Jelliffe. Both Carl Jung and Freud, as I said, were contemporaries of his that he continued to keep up with. And so I think early on that they had established all of these relationships. World War I certainly stunted that for a while. But once things in Europe started to go a little bit back to normal, the communication lines opened once again. And that became especially helpful with the spread of this disease because it hit England very hard and shortly thereafter New York and spread throughout the United States. So it was a good chance for the English doctors and American doctors to be comparing case studies and tracking what this unknown disease was doing.
Was it known enough that people, sort of civilians walking around, might have had some anxiety about contracting this?
I didn't get the sense. I think certainly it was overshadowed, as we said, with the 1918 flu. I didn't get the sense that people were fearful of getting it. It was more like the newspaper accounts tended to sort of focus on the idiosyncrasies of the disease. It talked about people who fell asleep and they weren't awakened until a violinist was brought in and played their favorite music. A bride who awoke right on her wedding day. These cases ended up making it into the papers. Over time, it did become more disturbing. They did start closing some public funerals, things like that, because they weren't sure how this disease was spreading. So it was sort of a slow burn before people realized. And I think one of the cases that really brought this to the attention, at least in America, was J.P. Morgan's wife. She died of it in 1925. And at that point, it really made the rounds in the papers.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that doctors would do when a patient was first brought to them is they would try to eliminate all the other sort of possible suspects. What other kinds of diseases masqueraded as something like this initially?
I think mainly they were trying to rule out diseases like polio and meningitis. And especially with any kind of brain swelling, it's so many of the symptoms can overlap that it was hard to know really what the singular cause of it was. So they tried to rule out, once they did autopsies, they were able to see where in the brain the swelling was, so they would know whether or not it had been meningitis or encephalitis. But before that, when someone just came down sick, it was very hard to diagnose this. So even today, they're not sure of the accurate number of cases. And it sort of became a catch-all in the 20s for a lot of different diseases.
And there were some cases in which instead of falling asleep for a very long time, people wouldn't sleep, and that's what would kill them.
Right. This had just a bizarre spectrum of diseases, and there were, of symptoms, and there were cases of insomnia. And people cannot live a certain number of days without sleep, and eventually after about 2 weeks, these patients would die from a lack of sleep. They also started seeing unusual tics, and there was an epidemic of hiccuping. Someone died of hiccuping in Europe. So this disease had such an interesting effect on the whole spectrum of behavior disorders and mental illnesses.
Talk to us about the patient, Rosie, who had just a really, she seemed to be okay physically, but she was not okay mentally after she recovered.
Right. She is the most extreme case. And trying to find the case studies for this book, I really wanted to cover the spectrum because there are so many different types of cases, some milder, some that were fatal, some that they survived. Rosie's falls on the very extreme end. She was a child when she caught it, so the damage done was more to her frontal lobe and did cause the personality changes, and she developed self-mutilation, eventually pulling her teeth and her eyes. She remained completely aware and intelligent. She was in no way showing that she was hysterical or insane. The doctors were really struck by how calm she was. They think that the disease had damaged the pain mechanism in her brain, so she was not feeling any pain. And she could never answer why she did it. She said she just felt compelled to do it.
How often were you able to trace surviving relatives, people who had actually known the people that you wrote about?
You mean today?
Yeah.
Are
they out there?
I did not actually encounter many when I was working or researching on the book, in part because HIPAA violations apply to this, and I was trying to keep, unless it was a case that was well documented, like J.P. Morgan's wife, I was keeping the anonymity of the patients, if they even had a name or family mention. A lot of times these doctors just included them as case study one or two or three, and they were numbered. But it was interesting, since the book has come out, I have been getting contacted by a lot of people who had grandparents or great uncle or aunt that died of this disease, and several who have said, we thought that they were insane. We thought that they, and we thought it was hereditary. We worried that that was going to happen to us. I've gotten a couple of different letters and emails from people who, you know, have said, now this is a relief to know this was actually caused by the sleeping sickness and not something that we need to worry about genetically.
So with the exception of Mrs. J.P. Morgan, the people that we've talked about so far have not been famous or remarkable in any way. But there are some figures in history that it, now it appears may have suffered from this.
Right. There are two that I mentioned in the book because it's just interesting. They're both involved in World War One. Hitler was one of them. He was hospitalized towards the end of World War One and showed such a dramatic and erratic changes to his personalities that the doctors and the other patients really noticed it. And he has been diagnosed with everything. The entire spectrum of mental illnesses. They thought it could have been mustard gas poisoning. And one of the suggested diagnoses was encephalitis lethargica. There's no real way to ever know because a lot of his medical records ended up being destroyed in World War II. So, we'll never be able to answer if he had it, but it's interesting to me that it was at least prevalent enough that they considered that as a possible diagnosis. And the same was true for Woodrow Wilson. He had a case of the 1918 flu. He was in Paris working on the Versailles Treaty, and his physicians noted afterwards that there was a remarkable change in his personality. And they didn't know if it was a complication of the flu or if it was a stroke, but encephalitis lethargica has also been a possible diagnosis for that. They weren't sure if that was the case and the flu had really triggered this encephalitis in him or if it was a stroke. And there, again, no really way to prove it one way or the other.
How was Wilson different after the illness?
They said really beforehand he had been much more lenient. He was. He has this quote about if you try to impose too harsh of restrictions on Germany, you'll be building peace on quicksand. And eventually, after this, he recovered from this illness and from the flu and entered back into the negotiations. He fell on the side of England and France and imposed the most harsh punishments on Germany. And, of course, that ended up his prophecy ended up coming true. It was peace built upon quicksand, and World War II shortly followed thereafter.
So, Molly, we've talked about the fact that no one's quite sure what the initial infection was, and maybe it was a range of different conditions. Is there any evidence that everyone who ultimately came down with this had survived, maybe the 1918 flu?
It's really hard to say statistically, because they can't even say truly how many people had the flu. They estimate between 50 and 100 million people worldwide had the flu, and it had not been isolated in the blood yet, so there's no blood test to test for it. So it you know, they weren't even able to pin down true cases of the flu. And then even so, it was so widespread across the world that just by sheer chance, statistics alone, a coincidence, you could have had the flu prior to having sleeping sickness.
Are there really good preserved tissue samples for doctors to look at?
They have found some. A lot of this has been in conjunction with the flu studies. They found there's been interesting books written about it over the last few years, archived brain tissue from 1918 that doctors put away in England. And they were looking, there were doctors studying it for the flu virus, but now a group of doctors also looking for this, what could have triggered encephalitis lethargica, have been looking for signs of it there. They had several patients with sleeping sickness and archived their brain tissue as well. So far, they have not been able to find any evidence of the flu. And in some of the modern cases of this encephalitis lethargica, they have not found evidence of the flu. But even since I've published this book, just this fall, a group of doctors at St. Jude in Memphis have been looking at repercussions from the flu, specifically H5N1. That's an avian flu that's been, it was circulating a couple of years ago, very high mortality rate. It's not the one we've just passed through, 2009 H1N1. And their interest is in, the avian flu tends to really spark an immune response in humans. 1918 was an avian flu. And they have found that some of these survivors of H5N1 have been showing some of these neurological changes. They've been developing Parkinson's. There's been some psychological changes. So even today, there's this flu theory does certainly continue.
So it could be, once again, sort of the overzealous immune response that ultimately was trying to heal the body and cause some further damage.
Right, and started causing the swelling in the brain or just mistakenly attacking the brain itself.
What do you know about when a researcher wants to look at these tissue samples that are 80 years old now, what does it take to get permission to do that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm sure they have to get certain grants and access to these hospitals, for they're very well protected. Most of these studies seem to be going on in London and in England, not as many in the U.S., which sort of surprised me because the U.S. was as hard hit as England, and yet it's been largely forgotten here. Whereas in England, they continue to talk about it. The BBC did a documentary on it a couple of years ago. There's something called the Sophie Cameron Trust that's it was set up for Sophie Cameron, who died of this disease when she was, in her late teens. She had planned to be a doctor and died of encephalitis lethargica, so her parents set up this this fund for research. But I don't know exactly how you would gain access to it. There are so few, I'm sure it's very specialized.
You mentioned modern cases. This has not completely vanished from the surface of the earth.
Right. That's one of the things that continues to be a little disturbing. Sporadic cases of it have continued since the 1920s and 30s. One of the doctors I interviewed for this, who's now working at a children's hospital in Australia, has seen 25 pediatric cases of this. The BBC documentary on the subject showed a number of patients, including one woman in the throes of this encephalitis. She did recover. They showed her the tape of herself, and she just said it was remarkable. I can't believe that's me. It's unrecognizable. And today, knowing a little bit more about the immune system, they are treating these patients with steroids in hopes of calming the immune response.
Is this related in any way to what's called African sleeping sickness?
No, and there was actually some confusion about that early on when this first struck in the early 1900s. I think it was Simon Flexner in New York who wanted to call this a different name. So he ended up, most New Yorkers ended up calling it epidemic encephalitis in order to differentiate it from the one in Africa. But they're completely unrelated, and the one in Africa is actually a parasite spread by the tsetse fly, and it has a number of different symptoms, one of them being deep sleep.
Talk for a minute. I know that you've probably read hundreds, if not thousands, of different case studies. How have they evolved in terms of the sorts of things that doctors note? Obviously, the greater understanding you have, the more facts you can put into these reports. But how would one written in 1925 be different from one that was written today?
That really struck me when I started going through some of these case studies, because my fear was that I wouldn't find enough information to develop really human characters in this, that you wouldn't be able to understand what these patients were going through and to feel for them. And when I started going through the case studies, I was surprised to find how much more personal material was included. The doctors followed their patients, especially these that were involved in the vaccine trials, for a decade or longer. They included personal letters in their files. They included all kinds of personal information, not only their medical history, but about their marital status, if they were happily married, if they were having problems, their children, happy at work, stress, how much they drank, how much they exercised, some of what we see today, but then a lot, it delved even further into personal lives, which ended up making it easier to develop these real characters.
Mm-hmm. Because you could sort of imagine even the relationships between the doctors and the patient.
Right, and there were photos, so I was able to give physical descriptions, and their personalities were coming out in their letters and their relationships with the doctors.
Mm-hmm. Writing about all of these illnesses, did you have to get over in your career a long time ago that sense of fear that some nasty bug is out to get you?
I very often get asked if I'm a hypochondriac. I am not.
I guess you couldn't be.
Right. I wouldn't be able to study all this. But no, it doesn't worry me. I have two children, and somebody said, you know, every time they get a fever, are you afraid it's something like this? I do not worry at all. I'm not sure why. I don't know if I've just become so desensitized to it, maybe from reading about it so often, but it doesn't seem to cross over into my personal life.
Were you able to do most of this research from home base, or did you have to travel a lot to go read files where they were?
I had to travel mainly to New York. The bulk of this book is set in New York during this really fascinating time period, the 1920s and 30s. And so I went up there. The New York Academy of Medicine and also the Columbia Health Sciences Library both had files of these original case studies from the doctors and from the Matheson Commission and the vaccine trials. So I would have to go up there, and I usually just sat in the library all day and hand-copied these. Most of them are historic. They're protected, so sometimes they can be Xeroxed, sometimes not. And so I would just hand-copy all these different details and go up a couple times a year and look through them.
There must have been moments when you found stuff and thought, oh, my gosh, I've been looking for months, and this is something I really need.
It was more that when I was looking for the case studies, this book is broken into seven different case studies with the same doctors weaving throughout. And it was mainly looking for the case studies when I would be really excited to run across just a great person, a great subject to write about.
My guest this hour is science journalist Molly Caldwell Crosby. Her new book is called Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Molly Caldwell Crosby. Her new book is called Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll go on the phones now to Kelly in Dallas. Hi, Kelly. Hello, Kelly.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, I just had a question. Your guest mentioned modern cases in Australia and in Great Britain, but I saw a segment recently on the Today Show about a young teenager here in the U.S. that has something that sounds very similar. She goes to sleep for like 6 weeks at a time. They can wake her briefly for her to eat something, but then she just sleeps. And then she can wake up, go to school for a couple weeks at a time, and then it hits again, and she goes to sleep for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks at a time. Hmm. I didn't know if that was a similar thing, the same thing, or if she knew about that case or what it was.
Right. I did. I actually saw that segment as well and was interested in it, looked it up. It's called Klein-Levin syndrome. I think that's how it's pronounced. And from what I understand, it's more of a sort of a sleep cycle that they continually do this throughout their lives. They can just go through these spells where they sleep. It's not brought on by an infection as far as they know, and it doesn't cause any lasting damage as far as they know. So I think it differs from the encephalitis lethargica in that respect, that it's just sort of turning the sleep cycles upside down for a while rather than causing any permanent damage.
You mentioned a couple of times the vaccine trials. How do you try to make a vaccine when you don't know exactly what the pathogen is?
That's a very good question. They were really just operating off of two or three different theories, and each team was going in a different direction. There was some thought that this might be related to the herpes virus somehow. There was some thought it might be related to the flu. And then there was a doctor who was working on one that had to do with strep. His particular focus was the type of strep that causes, strep A causes a number of different things. It's just a type of bacteria, and it causes scarlet fever, strep throat, a number of different ones. His focus was on infections in the teeth and in the mouth, which was very popular at this time. And they typically, their belief was that there was some sort of a focal infection going on around the teeth that then spread to the rest of the body, and it was sort of toxic. So they often pulled teeth and things like that as a way of treating it. So these different teams were working on vaccines and then just routinely trying them on the patients, not only those who were in acute stages of sleeping sickness, but those who had survived it and were developing Parkinson's and other ailments.
And nothing ever really took hold?
No, it didn't. And it was some patients, it's really hard to know how much of it was psychosomatic. Some of the patients did claim that they felt a lot better after certain vaccines than others and certain treatments. But this was going on in the 30s, and a lot of their funding was tied up in the stock market. So they lost a lot of money with the stock market crash and just couldn't keep up the funding, which was really sad for the doctors because they had grown to know these patients so personally, and they were taking away all of their hope. These patients were literally slowly freezing within to themselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking this hour with Molly Caldwell Crosby about her new book, Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Let's go next on the phones to Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, good afternoon, ladies.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Yes, this is most interesting, actually. It puts me in mind of a film, a 1930s film I saw in 1955, Boris Karloff, and the title was called Isle of the Dead, and the story was a party of people were escaping from mainland Greece, I think it was, to this island to escape from some disease or something, plague. And when they're in their big house on the island, one of them, a girl in her 20s maybe, suddenly appears to be dead, and they think, put the body down in the tomb in an old stone coffin. And I think it's the following night, or maybe the same night, I forget. There's a dreadful scream from inside this coffin, and poor soul manages to escape from the coffin, but she's totally insane by this time. And she finds a sharp instrument, shears, pair of scissors, somehow, and goes around the house, plunging it into the bodies of, I think, some of her companions. I can't remember the rest of it. Maybe I fainted at that point. I don't know.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you relaying that, because it does seem like the sort of thing that could inspire all kinds of scary stories.
You could see how this epidemic would be sort of rich with inspiration for that. And I did find some references to sort of the early German avant-garde films going on in the early 1930s that dealt with some of these sort of darker subjects where
Nosferatu.
Yes, exactly. And where it was, sometimes it was cases of hypnosis, but they had a number of different stories where it was someone controlling a sleeping person, or they would describe the person as not alive yet not dead. And sort of these, in one story, this doctor controls the sleeping person and convinces them to murder on their behalf. So you could see how this epidemic was certainly would be very inspiring, creative.
This is all also an interesting reminder of how little we really understand about sleep yet. There's so much about the process that scientists are still exploring.
Right. It's still, the brain is still just so difficult for scientists to understand and pin down a lot of these illnesses. So yes, you're right. That is a problem that they have with it.
Why do you think we have not seen a widespread outbreak of this since the time when it was all over the world?
That's one of the things that they are concerned about, because they're not sure what caused it. They can't say if it's going to recur. And again, these problems with the flu, and if there is a connection to that, and as you were saying a minute ago about the sleep, that they have in the past in history seen these sleep disorders arise out of flu. So if their concern is if there's another flu pandemic, if there might be an epidemic of this as well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, the one thing that we've learned over the last few years with this sort of almost pandemics, the things that were thought that they might get much worse than they ultimately did, we've learned a little bit more about how to communicate. Would it be helpful in a case like this if, you know, with modern epidemiological practice, if the WHO could sort of step in and identify this early on?
It would. I think one of the difficulties in diagnosing it today, it sort of fell out of the medical books years ago when Oliver Sacks was doing his research, when a number of these doctors that are currently doing research had not learned it in medical school. They may have learned it as von Economo's encephalitis, but not in any way to diagnose it. It was more just sort of a medical history interest, or the doctors today had read Awakenings by Oliver Sacks and were familiar with it that way. And then could research it out further. But I think a lot of doctors would just be struck with this, you know, the plethora of unusual symptoms and not know how to give it any one single diagnosis, not know how to recognize it. So it would take a while before it would even be recognized as an epidemic.
Now, Sacks treated his patients with L-DOPA, is that right?
Yes. He recognized that in their very still, almost catatonic states, they were wheelchair-bound, that it was an extreme form of Parkinson's that had caused their muscles to just stop moving entirely. It was their tensed still.
Which can be really painful from some of the cases you've described.
Right. And then he wanted L-DOPA was the brand new drug out that they were using to treat Parkinson's, and he thought it may work with these patients, and did. And he was briefly able to give them these awakenings, which was incredible. They were able to talk to family members for the first time in 40 years and to describe what it was like being trapped inside. And the tragedy of the story is that he's never able to maintain those levels of L-DOPA, and the patients stop responding to it or start having terrible side effects. And eventually they all ended up back in that original state.
Mm-hmm. Are there institutionalized patients today who are dealing with something like this?
Do you mean the extreme form of Parkinson's?
Yeah.
Or not that I know of. I think most of the studies, it was interesting in the 60s. And so, you know, they were looking back at this epidemic and they thought for a while it was the cause of Parkinson's. And they thought they had, you know, finally solved Parkinson's disease. And one of them even estimated that we'll be gone by 1980. This disease will be completely unheard of. And obviously, that is not the case. But I don't think they see this extreme form of it. It may be that some of these patients, they got it so early in their life, if they could, you know, if they were getting it in their 20s and 30s, that, you know, over the years, they really did develop this rapid and extreme form of Parkinson's.
You talked earlier about having to travel several times to New York to sort of be in situ and read these case studies. Is more of this information being put online so that researchers and journalists and other people can access it easily?
I know some of the scientists that I spoke with and researchers working on this are working on books themselves, and one of them is trying to put together a database that's going to cover a lot of the cases from the 20s and 30s to get a more accurate idea of how widespread this disease was or if it was being overdiagnosed, and also to recognize cases today because, you know, there's a case that I cite in here that actually happened in Texas, and it was a high school football player, and the doctor only recognized it and was able to diagnose it because he was a medical history buff. He had an interest in Constantine von Economo and read some of his early sleep research, and that was how he was able to recognize it.
Talk for a minute about how things turned out for your grandmother. It doesn't seem like this was something she talked a lot about.
No. She, after researching this book, I did realize she came out of it better than a lot of these patients. She never had the physical disabilities. She did not develop Parkinson's later in life. But I think she did stay very detached and distracted are the best words I can think of to describe her. And family members would just always say, oh, she's been that way since the great sleeping sickness epidemic.
So they remembered her changing.
They did. They remembered her changing, and I was, from a child's perspective, didn't really recognize it as unusual for a long time, or that she just seemed elderly to me. But now, you know, we know that now she had really been that way for most of her life. And I think later years of her life was depressed, probably, if she was aware enough of her feelings to be depressed, which was also very common of these patients.
So when you spend years of your life researching one relatively arcane topic, is it almost a mourning process once you're finished and you're ready to move on to the next thing? And I know you're still heavily involved with promoting the
right.
book.
No, I guess not.
Are you
really
done with it?
I am kind of done with it. I turned it in a year ago for to start the editing and publishing process. So that gives me kind of a break from it before I have to start talking about it again. But no, it's more that I just, you know, have read through it. I'm so familiar with it forwards and backwards by now.
And how does it work as you're casting about for the next thing that you want to study?
I am actually looking at a non-medical topic for perhaps a more natural history slant, something something historical. And I really enjoyed this time period, really between the two world wars. It was fascinating to me. And so I may look for something written more in that time period. I didn't intend to do two back-to-back medical histories. My first book was about the yellow fever epidemics in this country and Cuba and elsewhere. And when I started thinking of another book idea, I just remembered a project I had worked on in graduate school about my grandmother and about her illness, and looking into it, researching it, realizing there's just nothing out there on it, that it seemed like a good window of time to research and write this book.
And I think I read somewhere that initially when you were, maybe it was your previous book, but you were encouraged to write like Hot Zone 2, and you didn't want to do that.
No, right. When I was shopping around my first book, and my agent was taking it to various publishing houses, and a lot of them were wanting more of this push to be drama. You know, it's it's Outbreak, it's Hot Zone, that kind of thing. And neither of the disease I've written about would be could be considered that without being considered alarmist. I mean, and to me, really, the story is the epidemics themselves. My point is to try to put the reader in one of those epidemics. That's what inspired me to write these books, because we can't really imagine it today, but these were the earthquakes and hurricanes and fires of that age. They shut down cities. They altered lives. Doctors literally died studying these diseases. So really, for me, it was always the more the history of it and trying to transport myself back to the actual epidemic more than it was what was happening today or in the future.
And I guess maybe it's the human stories. I'm curious about what your perspective is on this. It makes sense that doctors and scientists would want to read books like this, but you have a sort of a general interest audience as well. What do you think gets people who will never deal with someone who has sleeping sickness so fascinated by a story like this?
I think mainly just because it's a good story. It's it's these people. You get to know them. You care for them. The doctors, you really get to pull for them. It's always much more about the people than the disease to me. The disease is just secondary. It's the same approach as taking some of these great books that I've read about natural disasters and, you know, having a hurricane hit and then going back in and seeing the victims survive and how people get through it and what happens to a city, how it alters history. That's always the approach I've taken in these. And I love creative writing, so I always think of it from more of a novel's perspective, even though this is nonfiction.
Did you have one particular character that you wish that you could speak with?
Yeah, I would love to get to know Jalief. He sounded fascinating to me. He was just brilliant. When he died, he left a collection of 15,000 books to a library. He was a great dad with all these kids who all of his children grew up to speak five or six different languages. At night, they sat around the dinner table and spoke these different languages. He would take them on these fascinating trips to teach them things. So he just sounded like a really interesting person.
Putting us all to shame to this day.
Yes.
Molly Caldwell Crosby's new book is called Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Molly, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.